Oyez, oyez, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 060023, Missouri Pacific Railroad Company, DBA Union Pacific Railroad Company versus Patricia Limmer, Billy Joyce Smith, and Bobby Jean Knopfnagel. And docket number 060778, the City of El Paso et al. Versus Lily M. Heinrich from El Paso County in the 8th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted, and Justice O'Neill will be sitting in both cases. She could not be here today because of a family emergency. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments and has allotted the State of Texas 5 minutes as amicus curiae in the second case. The court will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 060023, Missouri Pacific Railroad versus Patricia Limmer.
May it please the court, Mr. Hatchell will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, the issue in this case is whether state law negligence claims of the plaintiffs involving signalization or the adequacy of signage at a railroad crossing were preempted by two federal programs. One federal program to install retroreflective crossbucks and another program to enhance those crossbucks with retroreflective material on the verso of those and around the posts. Normally, in a preemption case, all of the heavy lifting is trying to determine whether the statute and the regulations create preemption. And for better or for worse, a lot of the heavy lifting has been done in this case for the court because the United States Supreme Court, in two cases that are with which the court is doubtless familiar, Easterwood and Shanklin, has determined that Federal Railroad Safety Act and companion acts and the regulations promulgated under those acts do create preemption. The preemption in our case is somewhat conditional. In other words, there have to be certain conditions met before preemption applies, and that's what the fight is about today. I would be less than candid with the court if I told you that, as I reviewed the briefing for this case, that the panoply of decisions following Easterwood and Shanklin on how do you prove federal preemption are inconsistent in many respects. They have different analytical frameworks and can result in a confusing pile that I hope to try to straighten out this morning. I mentioned the conditions, so let's try to start there. What we call the B3 and B4 regulations promulgated by the Secretary of Transportation, according to the Supreme Court, preempt state court tort claims concerning the adequacy of all warning devices installed with the participation of federal funds. That's the quotation from the Shanklin case that is the benchmark for where we begin. So there are two important concepts, participation of federal funds and the installation of a warning device in a federally approved project. So much the good. Now comes the hard part. And what I would propose to do this morning is to try to make the court's burden much easier. I think that I can give the court the proper analytical framework under the 1989 TAPE program by asking three rhetorical questions. And I think it can answer the 1977 retroreflective crossbuck question by asking the court to simply ask one rhetorical question. Let's look at the 1988 program because the resolution of that is virtually legal in nature. It does not have much of a factual component to it. The first of the three questions that the court needs to ask is, was there a participation of federal funds in the application of retroreflective tape to the backs of the crossbugs and their posts? And the answer to that is clearly yes. This is the easy fruit in the case. We proved that the tape project was eligible for and got state funds. That's undisputed. We proved that the state tape kit, which was purchased or which was ultimately funded with state funds, was in fact applied to both the backs and the posts of the crossbucks at the crossing in question. The Limmer's expert conceded that the tape was installed with federal funds. Question number one clearly answered is yes. There were federal funds expended, and that's really undisputed. Was there an installation? And there's a lot of discussion in the briefing as to whether putting tape on something is an installation. Well,
what about the tape being a traffic control device?
That's question issue. Number three, and I'm happy to deal with that. So let me just get to as to why there is an installation. The Texas Act, which required the tape to be installed, calls it an installation. The letter of approval from the Federal Highway Administration calls it an installation. And the State Highway Department rules, which govern the application of the case, three times call it an installation, which leads to Justice Medina's question. Was the tape a warning device? And we say yes, it clearly was a warning device. We take our touchstone to be the definition of passive warning device in the regulations passed by the Secretary. The reason we do that is because it is those regulations and those regulations only that the United States Supreme Court said cover the subject matter of the state tort laws and therefore preempt state law. So what do those regulations say? There is no question that the crossbucks in question and the tape would be a passive warning device. So under the regulations, passive warning devices are those types of traffic control devices, including signs, markings, or other devices to indicate the presence of a cross.
Do you agree that there's no evidence in the record that federal funds were expended to install the crossbucks?
No, I don't agree with that at all. That is the second of our points, and that is
at this specific crosswalk. You think there's conclusive evidence of that?
Well, I do think yes, there is. I think that there is evidence that has been accepted by other courts, particularly federal courts, that is matches ours exactly. And so that is the second part of the argument. But well, yes, we definitely do.
And you can get to that when you do. But I want to know where is the evidence that the crossbuck was purchased with crossbucks here were purchased with federal funds specifically for this railroad crossing?
Well, first of all, the crossbucks are not purchased. The installation of crossbucks are funded.
Right.
What we have in this case is an affidavit from Mr. Kosmak, who was the administrator of the program. And if you read his affidavit, he specifically states, and that affidavit was not challenged or offered to be struck, he specifically states that funds were allocated to District 17, and particularly the crossing, which has a specific number in this case, that all of those funds were expended. 100% of the funds were expended. There is attached to his affidavit a listing of all of the crossings that were in, not by name, but the number of crossings that were in District 17.
But this was a factual decision made by the trial court, and apparently there's some evidence to question the author's credibility.
Well, that is true up to a point. First of all, Your Honor, let me say that we have stood to the proposition that we must prove before this court federal funding as a matter of law. We eschewed trying the matter to a jury because we believe it is a matter for the court. There is no challenge to Mr. Kosmak's affidavit regarding, number one, the records, the state records which are attached, which were proved up as records, and which, of course, eliminates all hearsay objections. There was no objection to his statement that funds were appropriated for District 17 and for the crossing in question. But and that type of testimony alone was accepted by District Judge Kendall in the McDaniel case, and it was accepted in the O'Bannon case, and I believe two other cases. But we actually went farther in this case to prove federal funding of the crossbox, because what we did was we, in addition, we proved from a man who had actually been to the crossing and who administered the crosswalk program that the actual crossbucks that were standing at the crossing in question were like those which were installed under the program, under the federal program. There is also a testimonial statement by Mr. Kosmak that he was certain that federal funds were applied. He just didn't know the dollar amount. That is the part that is has been brought into question, but quite frankly, it's irrelevant to the analysis, because we believe that prior to that particular statement, the evidence is more than sufficient to establish as a matter of law that federal funds erected were participated in the erection of the original retroreflective crossbucks. One additional factor is the application of the tape itself, because the tape could only be applied to a compliant crossbuck. So the fact that the tape was actually applied, and it's conceded to applied, is further evidence that the metal crossbucks that were standing the day of the accident were federally funded crossbucks.
Even if those two positions were correct, and we're not saying I'm not saying that they are, but if they were correct, would you still have the issue as to whether or not this tape is a safety device?
Absolutely.
And if it's not, would you concede that preemption would not apply here?
Well, it would not apply as to that program.
Would it apply to this specific crossing?
But it would. But preemption would apply under the 1976 Act because of the crossbuck standard by itself. In other words, there are two independent bases, either one of which is appropriate. And I want to answer your question about whether or not tape is a passive warning device, because it's a very, very important question. As I indicated, a passive warning device is a traffic control device that includes signs, markings, or other devices to indicate the presence of a crossing. And that the tape is clearly that. It's a sign. It's a marking. I mean, it conveys a very important message. The letter announcing the tape program stated that the tape was to attract the driver's attention to the presence of a moving train at the crossing.
Haven't there been federal judges that have ruled otherwise?
There have been federal judges that have, in a way, ruled otherwise. Some have found they're not entirely certain, and I think the clearest holding is by Justice Folsom in the Enriquez case, but unfortunately, Justice Folsom's analysis is defective, and I'll tell you why. But I want to answer your question more fully. The letter announcing the tape states that it is designed to attract the driver's attention to the presence of a moving train at the crossing, which satisfies the requirement that the warning device indicate the presence of a crossing. The Texas Act says that the tape had to be affixed so that it focuses the attention to the presence of a non-signalized crossing. The approval letter from the Federal Highway Administration called the tape program one to enhance warning sign visibility. So there just is no question that the application of the tape was designed to indicate the presence of a crossing. And there's also no dispute that that is a warning. It's the flickering effect that warns motorists not to proceed. Now, as to the reason why I think Judge Folsom's contrary conclusion in the Enriquez case is analytically flawed, he fails to, in my judgment, do two things. One, he fails to look at the definition of passive warning device and go through the analysis that I have just done with Your Honor to fit the tape itself into the definition of passive warning device. But even more important than that, Judge Folsom overlooks the fact that when you install the tape onto the back of a crossbuck, in effect, what you are doing is erecting a new crossbuck, because it's very clear from submissions from the Federal Highway Administration that improvements and upgrades essentially result in the installation of a new device, and you look at that new device to determine the application of federal preemption, and that new device is determined to be adequate. And it is the adequacy of the device that preempts state law.
Does your argument rest on the enhanced visibility of the
crosswalk?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So what about the respondent's argument that would a spotlight on an existing crosswalk at night be a warning device or a traffic control device?
Easily could be if the Secretary approved it as such.
Are you going to spend some rebuttal time talking about the jury questions?
Be happy to. And Mr. Chief Justice, you were interested in the 1976 program, and I wanted to give you the rhetorical question that I would ask today. Under the evidence that I outlined for you, what is the degree of likelihood that the crossbuck standing that matched entirely the federal program were not installed with federal funds? There are two cases that the abandoned case case in particular, and other two other cases that say a metaphysical doubt that the crossbucks might not have been installed with federal funds is insufficient. And I think that's all you have here. All the argument that you hear is simply to raise a metaphysical doubt.
Mr. Hatchell, if there was a dead tree at the crossing with no limbs, no obstructions around it, and federally funded tape was put on that tree, would that suffice?
Absolutely.
How much tape? And does it have to be in a certain design or a certain amount?
As long as it's approved by the Secretary, it is sufficient. A very good place for the court to look is Attorney General Cornyn's amicus brief in the Shanklin case, which outlines the procedures that states have to go through to do exactly what you're talking about. There have to be elaborate proposals, plans, and specifications of the devices. And if the Secretary has a device presented for federal funding and he determines that tape put up on a dead tree is sufficient and expends federal funds, then that is more than sufficient to create preemption because of an oftentimes overlooked provision of the Act, which says that no funds shall be approved for expenditure unless proper safety protective devices complying with safety standards determined by the Secretary at the time as being adequate shall be installed and be in operation.
Agree with you, wouldn't we have to disagree with all three federal district judges? Even Judge Sim Lake says tape standing alone is not a warning device. We'd have to disagree with all three of them, wouldn't we?
Well, you would probably have to disagree. I'm not sure, quite frankly, if you read Judge Lake's opinion, that he was all that certain. He just said it was not clear.
He concludes there's a fact question.
Well, he said, he said it was not clear to him that the application of tape would be the installation of a warning device.
But that doubt seemed to be connected to the fact that there was a crossbuck also there that it was placed on. But he does state pretty succinctly and independently that tape standing alone is not a warning device.
And the analytical flaw in that is you don't consider tape standing alone. What you do is you consider the definition of warning device, and you consider not whether or not that tape has been integrated into a warning device. I think it is standing alone, but there's no question that once it is integrated into a warning device, that it functions as a warning device. The application of the federally funded tape to a warning device creates a new warning device that is adequate.
Any further questions? Thank you, Councilman. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Ms. Hankinson will present argument for the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Hatchell and I have a fundamental disagreement that this case is only about preemption. We also believe it is about the site obstruction claim and the jury charge issues. I hope in the time that I'm allowed that I will be able to address both issues. Our briefs meticulously and methodically detail both the preemption legal analysis, including the interpretation of the applicable statutory and regulatory language, and the evidence. It can be summarized with two conclusions. First, we are on the side of strict construction regarding the preemption issues presented. The preemption rule is a bright line rule. It is not subject to the kind of fuzzying up that you just heard from Mr. Hatchell. Federal funds must participate in, quote, the installation of a warning device. That cannot be separated into two phrases. This has been clearly prescribed by the United States Supreme Court in the Easterwood and Shanklin decisions.
So if you put up a octagonal sign painted white and the feds pay for the red paint, it's not a stop sign if it's painted white, right? But if the feds and red paint standing alone in the closet would not be a traffic control device. But if the feds pay for the red paint to paint it red and put stop on it, that's involved in the installation of a traffic control device, right?
Well, if it is a traffic control device as defined by the MUTCD, you have to actually install the device. And that is the applicable law. The MUTCD is the standard.
So let's say you've got flashing red lights and the feds pay for the light bulbs. I agree the light bulbs standing alone at Lowe's or Home Depot are not a traffic control device. But if the feds pay for the light bulbs that make it flash, why isn't that federal payment for a traffic control device?
Because it is not a traffic control device as defined by the MUTCD.
Which part of the definition doesn't fit?
It does not fit the definition of under the MUTCD because it does not regulate, warn, or guide traffic. The bulb itself does not do that. This is a bright line rule, Your Honor. A bright-line rule. The Supreme Court was very, very clear. The railroads came to the Supreme Court asking for much broader preemption, and the court said no. Look at the decision in Easterwood. In Easterwood, they determined that the motion detector circuitry was not a warning device. It does not regulate, warn, or guide traffic, which means it does not give any information to the driver in order to allow them to make decisions. So that kind of thing does not, that's why I say it's a bright line rule. And if you look at all the federal authority, it is a bright line rule. The MUTCD has a listing of all of the kinds of traffic devices. You will not find reflective tape in there anywhere.
Could I be sure that you do agree that federal funds were spent on installing the tape?
We do, Your Honor.
So you would think then that a floodlight or spotlight on the crossbugs would not?
It would not be. The regulations say that all traffic control devices must comply with the MUTCD. The Secretary has incorporated the MUTCD into the regulations. We have an official ruling.
Under that theory, if the feds give you the wood and the paint and the poles, and we have prison inmates actually paint the crossbugs. The feds weren't involved in providing a traffic control device. Poles don't warn you about anything.
Well, no, they don't. The paint and the poles separately don't. If when put together, at that point in time, that is taken out there, planted into the ground as a traffic control device that comes within the definition of the MUTCD.
Unless the congressman paint the signs, it's not a traffic control device.
Well, no, I don't think I said that, Your Honor.
I'm saying if they give you a completed sign.
That's correct. A complete traffic control device as has been defined in the MUTCD. Look at the official ruling from the Department of Transportation on this. Go to the website and see that this is an official means by which the Department of Transportation communicates so that we have uniform standards. They issued an official ruling that tape is not a traffic control device.
That's a very brief one-sentence statement in a letter with no explanation. It's hard to know exactly what they meant by that. Let me ask,
Your Honor,
if there's a federally funded crossbuck, and the feds fund the placement of an additional arm off that existing crossbuck that's and there's a round sign that says stop railroad crossing. Is that additional sign a warning device?
I'm not sure that I understand what the additional sign is, Your Honor.
It's a arm hanging off the 50-year-old crossbuck, and on the arm that's been attached, it says stop railroad crossing.
It is not the installation of a traffic control device. When I say it's a bright line rule, it is a bright line rule. And the federal courts have been very, very precise about this.
So what if that arm was put on the crossbuck at the time that the whole crossbuck was put in the ground? So you have the crossbuck, you have the pole, and then you have the arm I'm talking about that says stop railroad crossing. All that's federally funded, put in the ground at the same time.
That's a traffic control. If that meets and what you've put in falls within what the MUTCD says, which it sounds like it does, then it would be a traffic control device.
But if you put the crossbuck and the pole in the ground and then come back a month later and put the additional arm that says stop railroad crossing, the additional
That's
arm
right.
is not,
That's
in
right.
your opinion, a warning device.
It is not. It is not. The regulation uses the word installation of warning devices. The Supreme Court has very strictly construed what that means. It does not mean maintaining. It does not mean enhancing. It does not mean any of those things. It means actually installing a traffic control device. We have very meticulously in the brief walked the court through the statutory and regulatory language and how all the pieces fit. And the official ruling in the letter from the Department of Transportation, if the court will go to the website that the Department of Transportation has up talking about these official rulings, then you will see that that is in fact the case. The Court of Appeals analysis here about the tape is right on, and it comports with what the federal judges are saying about it. If this court decides that tape, reflective tape, in and of itself, is a warning device, meaning a traffic control device, it will go it alone, contrary to what the federal government is saying and the federal courts are saying.
Mr. Hatchell says that he's proved conclusively that the crossbuck was, that federal funds were involved in the installation of the crossbuck. What's your response?
He has not, Your Honor. This is the dirty macaroni case turned around with a defendant trying to use dirty macaroni to become not just some evidence, but conclusive evidence.
Could I ask you a question about that? We understand that the railroad must establish this as a matter of law, so conclusively proved. But I was wondering, and you're quite right, the briefs are very thorough about going through the evidence. But I was wondering, is there any affirmative evidence that the crossbucks could have come from some other source than the federal fund?
Yes, there is, Your
Honor. As opposed to just the possibility that is not foreclosed.
Yes, Your Honor, there is evidence. If you look at the letter that documents the program, what you see is that the letter refers to existing crossbucks and the fact that existing crossbucks will not be replaced, that this is not a put a crossbuck everywhere. So the letter reflects the fact that in this district and around the state, there were existing crossbucks that were in place.
That complied with the federal.
Yes. Guidance. All right. And so that is some evidence of the fact that there were crossbucks in place. We don't know what happened. The interesting thing about preemption here is that this case has always been about the 1977 program until it landed in this court. It was about the 1977 program when it was tried. It played a very minor role. When we went to the Court of Appeals, it was the lead preemption article, the preemption issue, and the Court of Appeals looked at that superficial argument that they made and took the bait on it, just like a couple of federal judges had done. But what ended up happening along the way is the court took a second look, just like Judge Folsom did. And what he found, which has now been exposed nationally, is the fact that We had a representative here in Texas who was testifying under oath to things that he did not have personal knowledge of.
That's the Kosmak
affidavit? Yes, sir. That he was testifying to things he didn't have personal knowledge of, that he had signed affidavits in federal court indicating that federal funds were spent at crossings when he had no knowledge of it, and there was no record that could support it, and when he was asked the questions under oath, his testimony contradicted his affidavits.
It seems to me is why Judge Folsom made the decision that he did make.
Exactly right. And you can see the two decisions of Judge Folsom. They took the Johnson decision to the Court of Appeals the day before oral argument, the first time. Enriquez came out in the meantime. And Judge Folsom saw through what was going on. This has been a sham evidentiary matter. Those are the words that are being used. This is not conclusive proof, nor can it be bucked up by looking at Mr. Woods with what, quote, appears to be reflective crossbucks. In light of the fact that there's conflicting evidence, and in light of the fact that there are all the evidentiary problems about how meager that is under this court's evidentiary review.
I want to get to the jury issue, but if... the Brooklyn Bridge was built 100 years ago with federal funds, but everybody that built it and all the records have all disappeared. So, and same situation here. If the Brooklyn Bridge was built by federal funds, everything's state laws preempted. And your situation is if you just wait long enough for the bridge to fail, when everybody's died and the records are all gone, then the preemption disappears.
I disagree with that analysis, Your Honor. I think that if this were a plaintiff who were here trying to make a case and the records were gone, the court would say you didn't uphold your burden.
I don't care who wins or loses. I'm just trying to get the point you're making is if these were with federal funds and Congress said then if we preempt state law, in fact Congress's preemption disappears when everybody Let me finish. When everybody who did it dies and when the records are thrown away. So preemption dies with the records and the people.
It doesn't die with the records and the people.
How would you prove it?
It can't be proved then. But that doesn't mean the preemption dies. The Supreme Court has said, and we all know, that preemption is an affirmative defense and it must be proved. If you don't have the evidence, does that mean that a court steps in and says, well, sorry, the evidence is gone. We'll give one side the benefit of the doubt and decide there's evidence. It's just a fact of life in terms of the way things are handled, but it does not in any way lessen the responsibility of the defendant to prove conclusively now before this court that there is preemption.
Is there any reason why Congress couldn't simply, through the Commerce Clause and whatnot, preempt all claims involving crossing accidents?
It could, but it didn't. And that's the whole point. And that's what was the debate in Easterwood and in Shanklin, because that was the position that the railroads took. And at that point in time, Solicitor General Starr came into the Supreme Court with a brief on behalf of the government saying that is not what Congress intended. It is not field preemption. It is subject matter preemption. And if you look at all the federal authority dealing with preemption issues, for example, site obstruction, you'll see that the federal courts will not apply the warnings regulation to preempt site obstruction claims. They evaluated speed in the Shanklin case to see if it was preempted under that regulation. There is no intent by Congress to displace totally state law and state regulation or responsibility on the part of the railroads with respect to railroad crossings.
Let's turn to the jury charge.
The jury charge issue that is before the court looks at three different issues. The first issue has to do with whether there's preservation, the second, whether there's even error, and finally, whether or not there is harm. We believe that under existing Texas law, this is an issue at all three levels that weighs in favor of, and in fact, the Limmers should win. First, let me just briefly mention this case was not tried on the basis that there was no duty on the part of the railroad to keep the tracks free of site obstruction. They tried it fully because we have a regulatory scheme in Texas, both by regulation under the Transportation Code and as a result of the state using the AASHTO site guidelines for evaluating how site obstructions need to be dealt with. They admitted at trial that they had a duty under Texas law. That duty exists. They have admitted, their witnesses admitted they have a duty. The state of Texas came in and admitted that they held UP to a duty. So it was tried that way. This is a new argument that came up on appeal. It's the public policy of this state. The old cases can be harmonized with each other, as we've discussed, and can be harmonized with the regulatory scheme. The idea that there is no duty here is just amazing. The federal courts have all recognized site obstruction claims as being different than inadequate warnings claims. The preemption analysis is different. So with that background, where did we find ourselves when it came time to submit the charge to the jury? The objections that were made by the railroad to the charge with respect to the liability issues were these. That number three, which is the site obstruction issue, was a, quote, double dip of number one, takes number one and number two to get you to an inadequate warnings finding, but it was a double dip. It was a shade of. The same facts were going to be considered under number one as would be under number three.
And you agree with that?
That it is a double dip?
Well, that it's included in one and two.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor.
I thought the harm argument was that...
I agree that the facts are subject to being considered with respect to both. But I disagree that they meld into one negligence theory.
Well, then...
The law recognizes more than one duty. Excuse me?
Well, then there could be harm. I thought the harm argument was there can't be harm because...
That's right.
...three's in one and two.
The facts are in one and two. This is a granulated liability submission. And the reason why it was granulated is because the second objection that the railroad made was that the site obstruction claim, which they acknowledged they had a duty under in the trial court, was preempted by the warnings regulation. And they also agreed that the negligence in the warnings issue was preempted by the same regulatory scheme. As a result of that, these issues were granulated because the preemption analysis is different. That's why it was granulated.
Why is the... I mean, it seems to me I'm having trouble keeping it out and putting it in. It seems to me if it's in, then I understand your harm argument. It couldn't have hurt anybody because
that's right.
It was just part of the rest of the charge. But if it's out, then there could be.
Now, my point is, Your Honor, that if you did a broad form submission... then you could ask it together. But the point is that it had to be granulated because we don't have field preemption. This court, if we had put them together, we would be here with them arguing we're unable to say to the court, even though there's no preemption of site obstruction, because it's wrapped into the first issue on liability. That's my point about why it's separate, is it's tied to the need to be analyzed the preemption differently. But second of all, they claim there's no duty under Texas law, which they've claimed for the first time on appeal, and there is. So there's not any error in saying to the jury, we're going to let you decide that. Now, here's what happens next. They say it's a double dip. If it's a double dip, they're saying it's a duplicitous issue. This court has held, at least as early as 1929, that a duplicitous submission is never error, harmful error. It's not. That was the only thing the judge was on notice of that was the complaint. And if you look at Texas law, we know it wouldn't be harmful.
But you're saying it's not duplicative. You said it wasn't duplicative. It had to be set out. That's my confusion.
Well, it's not duplicative from the standpoint that if you're going to granulate, it's not duplicative. If you asked a broad form negligence question, without specifying specific types of negligence, then it becomes one.
Well,
I want to make sure I'm trying to answer your question and we're not communicating.
You say it's duplicative. The law's been this way since for a long time, that can't be harmful. But it's not duplicative because we had to separate it out because it's a different issue.
Well, it's a negligence issue, Your Honor. I mean, it is. You could ask, was the railroad negligent and was it the proximate cause? And if it were a true broad form submission, that's what you'd ask. But given the fact that the preemption issue was different for the two, you had to put the negligence issue as a granulated submission. And that's what it was. But there's no question that with respect to surrounding circumstances include the state of the obstructions that are at the crossing. So the point is that, first of all, on preservation, the preservation issue, we have no objection to comparative causation. That's a broad form objection that the trial court was not on notice would be complained about. This allows them to speculate on the jury verdict. BLD and AV say otherwise, so do Castile and Harris County. And then, as Justice Hecht has said, with respect to the harm analysis, for it to be duplicative means that the jury is going to consider the same facts. That's what we were all on notice they were complaining about. It, with reasonable certainty, we know there was no harm. First, because this court says there's no harm from duplicative submission as a matter of law, and second of all, because it can't be harmful for the jury to consider facts in doing the comparative causation question that it is entitled to consider, which is what distinguishes this case from Romero on the harm analysis.
Any other questions? Thank you.
The court. I want to make four very brief points on preemption, and then I want to address Mr. Justice Willits and the other justices' questions about the jury charge matter. It's very important for the court to understand the argument that you have just heard. It sits like an inverted pyramid on the notion that the tape applied to the crossbucks was not a warning device because it is not defined as such in the MUTCD. The MUTCD has absolutely nothing to do with preemption, and that is found most of all in the Enriquez opinion, which is the best opinion that supports their position. The judge in that case, specifically plaintiffs contend that retroreflective tape does not meet the definition of a warning device per the MUTCD or passive warning device defined in the CFR. Whether the device meets the requirements of the MUTCD is irrelevant, and that is well grounded in the decisions of the United States Supreme Court.
Well, what relevance, if any, does this so-called sham evidence from the Cosmack affidavit have any of this?
Your Honor, I hate to get into the terms like that because this is all based upon references to a deposition taken in a case 2 years after this. There's no suggestion in this record that there's any kind of sham defense.
Judge Folsom states in his writing that the affidavit is contradictory and it's not explained.
Based upon the record in that case, he could make any determination he wants, but can this court look to Judge Folsom's opinion in a completely different record that is not before the court in violation of your holding in the Falcon Ridge case that you don't, you know, add to the appellate record by stuff from other cases? But the other important thing is that nobody questions Mr. Cosmack's credibility or truthfulness insofar as the state records are concerned. He verified the state records under the Business Transactions Act, the Business Records Act, and those are proved up without a doubt, and nobody has ever challenged that. And part of our argument is that those records alone, in conjunction with two or three other pieces of fact, establish federal funding conclusively.
So what about the preservation of error? In your opponent's brief, there's reference to not being specific in your objection and that maybe you were trial counsel was sandbagging in those objections. Address that, please.
First of all, the objection to the submission of question 2 and 3 was about as specific as I think you can make it. The objections that are quoted in the briefs, the objection essentially was that question 3 was an evidentiary matter, and it was not an ultimate issue. But that objection was augmented later by post-verdict motions, which also raised no evidence and other matters. I don't know if we raised immateriality or not. I frankly can't remember as we stand here today. So the question simply is whether or not question 3, which was the site restriction matter, was a viable ultimate issue for the court to decide. The Court of Appeals had absolutely no problem finding that we had raised our objections. They properly raised the objections they so held, and I cannot see any valid argument for saying that we did not. The issue, and then you go to the law underlying that, which I don't think has been seriously challenged, at least since the 1800s, that site restrictions are simply a matter to be taken into account as regards the operation of the train, and that is particularly underscored by the regulations of the Federal Highway Administration in this case, which bases both its speed determinations and the adequacy of devices on the basis of site restrictions.
Ms. Hankinson says the idea that there's no duty here is amazing. In her view, what do you say?
I think that the idea recognizes the real life fact that
Mr. Hatcher, you can get a
no,
glass of water.
No, that's fine. I think recognizes the real life fact that railroad crossings are dynamic, dynamic venues. They're constantly changing. And there are a number of legitimate instructions, both by the railroad and by third parties, that will inevitably be there. Thank you. So the policy of the law has been to allocate the risk of site restrictions to the drivers approaching the crossing and to the railroad. And therefore, they say it is wrapped up in those two determinations which were submitted in this case. The real battle in this case, Your Honor, has been over this argument that we had to object to the apportionment question. The difficulty with that argument is that the apportionment question is not erroneous. We had no objection to that, assuming that our objection was properly overruled to question 3. The apportionment question is where the impact of the harm is, and I think Justice Heck pretty much nailed that question in the Romero case. It is an unusual rule, it seems to me, that says that in making a valid objection to a submitted question, I also have to tell the trial court why the appellate court is going to find that the overruling of that objection is harmful.
Are there any further questions?
Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.